The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Stay on vacation. I'm not there. Ed Morrissey is in for me today. I hope you enjoy him as much as I do listening to him on the beach. Ed Morrissey, thank you 1,000 times. Take it away, Edward.
Welcome back to the Hugh Hewitt Show. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, coming to you from the great state of Texas. And boy, I tell you, we've got just a great show today. We've got so much Pittsburgh Steeler news. I want to really make sure that Hugh is proud of the work I'm doing. So we've got a ton of Pittsburgh Steeler news. But, you know, we've got a couple other things that we have to cover up front first before we get to all the great Pittsburgh Steeler news that we're going to be covering today. Because there's just a couple of things that might be slightly more important than Ben Roethlisberger. I'm just saying that, you know, Dwayne's kind of come up with a couple of other things that we probably need to address. For instance, I don't know if people remember this, but when the Cuban people began to rise up against the Castro regime last month, the Biden administration was curiously passive about this. There was a lot of questions as to whether or not
AWOL, passive.
Oh, well, you know, we could flood the zone with information and help them communicate with each other and organize, but, you know, I don't know if that's a great idea sort of thing.
Wasn't there calls and demands that we used our abilities, our resources, to be able to allow the Cubans to have internet after the Cuban regime locked them out?
Internet, cell phones, there's all sorts of things that we could have done, you know, but, you know,
we didn't do that. We couldn't do that. We didn't do that.
And as much as you're probably saying, but the Pittsburgh Steeler news is so much more important than what happened in Cuba, you know, a few weeks ago. I'd agree with you on that, except that the White House has now decided that they have a communication strategy to work around the regime of Ron DeSantis. in Florida. Well, at least it's close by. Cut four.
Well, first, from day one, we've approached this not as a political issue, but a public health issue.
Wait, stop.
When did they stop treating this as a political
issue?
From
day one, they treated this as not a political issue. So right off the top, we are 7.5 seconds into this cut, and she's already lied. I mean, demonstrably lied.
Remember when Joe Biden said we didn't have any vaccines when we came into the White House after he and Kamala Harris both had their two shots courtesy of the Trump administration in the weeks preceding their inauguration.
So 7.5 seconds into this cut, and she's already committing misinformation. She's already putting out disinformation, right?
Well, this is the kind of helpful information that Floridians can look forward to getting from the Biden administration. Apparently, starting yesterday. But let's keep going.
Jen Psaki continues.
Well, first, from day one, we've approached this not as a political issue, but a public health issue. We remain in touch with officials in Florida, just like we're in touch with officials from around the country about how we can provide assistance from the federal level to help address this public health crisis. What I have cited and what the president has cited is publicly available data about public health and the impact in Florida. It is factual and it is a fact and data that you all are aware of, that 25% of hospitalizations in the country are in Florida. It is also a fact that the governor has taken steps that are counter to public health recommendations. So we're here to state the facts. Frankly, our view is that this is too serious, deadly serious, to be doing partisan name calling. That's what we're not doing here. We're focused on providing public health data, information to the people of Florida to make sure they understand what steps they should be taking, even if those are not steps taken at the top of the leadership in that state.
Short takeaway, Ron DeSantis is worse than the Castro regime.
Well, I mean, and this is what we get. This is what we're getting to here is that this is the type of communication strategy that you would have expected the Biden administration to employ against the Castro regime when they started going after the protesters in Cuba, and they didn't do it. They refused to do it. They didn't want to. They didn't want to get their hands dirty. They didn't want to. They didn't want to help people out that were actually protesting against a decades-long tyranny. 90 miles off our coast, that they couldn't be bothered to deal with. But Ron DeSantis is a whole other story. And why? Because Ron DeSantis is going to run for president in 2024, and he's going to be one of Joe Biden's potential adversaries in that election cycle. It's clear what's going on here is that this is nothing but politics. This is Jen Psaki is saying, well, we're not political here. Of course you're political. I mean, If you want to get into that, I mean, they're not talking about that with Alabama, which has got the lowest vaccination rate in the country. You're not talking about that with some of the other states that have rolled back mask mandates. They're not talking about those states. They're talking about Florida. And Florida is one of those states that actually managed to make it through the pandemic economically and socially fairly sound.
Bad narrative. Bad narrative. It doesn't fit their narrative.
Well, of course it doesn't fit their narrative, but it doesn't fit the facts either. And so let's continue on the White House's obsession with Florida. Let's go to Education Secretary Miguel Cardona in Cut 6, where, again, DeSantis is clearly being set up as the bete noir of the Biden administration.
You know, don't be the reason why schools are interrupted. Our kids have suffered enough. Let's do what we know works. Let's do what we know works across the country. We shouldn't get politics. Doesn't have a role in this.
Wait. Politics is everything in this. Politics is everything in this. Florida is not the only state that is balking at requiring kids to be vaccinated in school, regardless of their vaccination status. There's a whole bunch of states that are balking at this. And DeSantis is hardly the only governor who's making this an issue.
Don't be the reason schools are closed. Do you know what the reason might be?
Randy Weingarten is the reason why schools are
closed. And what do the unions engage in? Politics.
This is all about politics. Let's not forget that the teachers' unions were the ones, Randy Weingarten up front, that were insisting that teachers had to be a priority for vaccinations. This is when the vaccines were relatively hard to come by, and they were saying, "Well, if you want us to reopen schools, you got to get the teachers vaccinated first." So we did. Most states prioritized teachers. They moved them up the line, even though teachers weren't a particular risk in any other category. They moved them up the line so they could get the schools open. And then the teachers union said, okay, now we're not going to open them up until the kids are vaccinated, which might be, you know, another year or two before you get all of the kids vaccinated. We still don't have an emergency use authorization for any vaccines for kids under 12.
Right. Governor Kate Brown of Oregon said, but wait, we had a deal. You told me to get the teachers. We did that. We had this deal.
And you know what else we don't know? You know what else is in play here is that the teachers' unions won't reveal what percentage of their members have actually been vaccinated.
Yes.
Because that would also interfere with the narratives. Because the people who are unvaccinated are all of the benighted, Donald Trump followers. And that's the only people who are not being vaccinated. I mean, that's simply not true. There's a lot of hesitancy among conservatives. There's a lot of hesitancy among Hispanics, among blacks. Among liberal enclaves, vaccine hesitancy is nothing new among liberal enclaves. It's been going on for years, and that predates COVID. These are the same enclaves that don't vaccinate their kids against, mumps and measles.
Right. We had an entire summer and fall of vaccine hesitancy birthed on MSNBC and CNN only because it was Donald Trump's vaccine. So therefore, we can't trust that. We can't take that.
No. And so Ron DeSantis did have an answer to this. We're going to squeeze this in here. Let's go to cut number eight. We're talking about what the actual impacts of COVID-19 are on the ground in Florida.
Now, there is a narrative being spun, Governor, by the White House and of course, the media that the Florida hospitals are busting at the seams, but we found part of a roundtable from Florida hospital CEOs this morning. Watch.
Right now, we're down to 25% of our inpatients in ICUs. Other hospitals in South Florida are seeing even less numbers than that, between 15 and 20% of their patients in ICUs.
80% of our patient census is non-COVID patients. These are critically ill patients, many of whom delayed care during the pandemic.
At TGH right now, we have 126 COVID patients.
Wow, that's a lot.
We're a 1,041-bed hospital.
Well, that's a lot more.
That's so much, yeah.
Governor, what's the real story here?
Well, I think those CEOs told the story. You know, we have had a summer wave. We've had seen significant increases in COVID patients. But as the CEO of Tampa General said, that's 10 to 15% of their total census. And it's important when the media is spreading this misinformation and actually lying, it could deter someone from going in to get care for things like heart problems.
Which
or
is
stroke.
A great point. So
it's a great point. Let's hold it right there because we got to go. But this is what hospitals are for. They're not being overwhelmed. We do want to keep an eye on it. Nobody's saying that we shouldn't. But let's get the truth out there. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Hugh Hewitt. We'll be right back.
All right. Send lawyers, guns, and money.
Welcome back. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Hugh. Send lawyers, guns, and money. That's what I think Joe Biden must be saying about his ATF pick, David Chipman, whose nomination is all but moribund on Capitol Hill. Joining us to talk about this is my friend Cam Edwards from BearingArms.com, host of Cam and Company. And we've been talking about David Chipman now for a while on our own VIP Gold Show at Hot Air and Bearing Arms. Cam, welcome to the show. And this I can't believe that the White House is still actually trying to get Chipman across the finish line here.
Good morning, Ed. And if you believe gun control activists, it's the problem is that the White House hasn't done enough.
I saw that yesterday.
Finish line. Yeah. Apparently, we've now reached the finger pointing and recrimination stage of the Chipman nomination. Politico reporting that several gun control activists, going after and criticizing the White House, saying that they've not done enough heavy lifting to get this nominee through. Now, I will note that according to Politico's comments, the gun control activist offering the most criticism is a guy named Igor Volsky from a group called Guns Down America, which I think Igor Volsky is probably one of the most ineffective gun control activists out there. So I think he's got to be loud to get some attention.
Right.
Because the White House really dropped the ball here. I don't think so. I mean, I think gun control activists, honestly, were the ones who really dropped the ball in pushing Biden to nominate one of their own as the head of the ATF. This was always going to be a controversial decision, and for very good reason. I mean, you've got a guy who views the firearms industry that he would be overseeing with a very adversarial, line of thought. He believes that the gun laws in this country are too loose. He believes that in order to give meaning to the lives of murder victims, we need to pass gun control. This guy's a gun control zealot. So I'm not surprised that Democrats are having a really hard time getting him across the finish line.
You know, and this is part of the problem, I think, that you run across when you're nominating activists. But, I mean, Chipman is a little bit more than just an activist, too. This is a man who was a paid lobbyist for two gun control organizations, including the entire 4 years prior to Joe Biden taking office. This is an administration that talked a lot about lobbyists and not getting lobbyists into government. And yet here you have a lobbyist for gun control groups that they're pushing through. And what is most frustrating about this for me, looking at the media coverage of this, is that nobody's mentioning the fact that this guy's a paid lobbyist and he's being asked to be put in charge of a law enforcement organization after spending years as a paid lobbyist on this issue or really any other. Democrats are supposed to be death on lobbyists. And when it comes right down to it, it's just that they don't like other people's lobbyists.
Well, that's exactly right, because David Chipman is actually still working for Giffords. I don't believe he stepped down. I think he's still collecting a check as a senior policy advisor for the gun control group. And you're right. But there have been a number of objections about David Chipman, whether it is his time as a gun control lobbyist, whether it is the views that he holds, whether it's allegations when he was at the Detroit ATF field office that he made disparaging comments about black agents. We've had, you know, corroboration from other agents in Detroit at that time. But Dick Durbin says, you know, this is just Republican smears. Then we found out this week that Chipman actually helped the Chinese government engage in a little anti-U.S. propaganda right after the Sandy Hook murders by appearing on Chinese state-run TV, an appearance he neglected to inform the Senate Judiciary Committee about when he had his confirmation hearing a couple of weeks ago, or a couple of months ago, excuse me. So, you know, again, I mean, there are all kinds of reasons to vote against Chipman. There haven't been any new reasons to come out to vote for him, which is why, you know, Angus King of Maine and John Tesser of Montana and Joe Manchin of West Virginia are still at least publicly undecided. Sounds like Angus King might really be more opposed to Chipman's nomination than what we're hearing from Tester and Manchin. But, you know, the bottom line is it looks like they were kind of setting a soft deadline, it sounds to me like, to get this nomination through before the August recess. And I don't think that's going to happen.
Well, and this is what I find interesting, is that yesterday, I believe it was yesterday, Politico was really focusing on Angus King as the fulcrum on this question. And he may well be. I mean, it may be that Angus King is more skeptical than anybody, than any of the three Democrats that haven't come out in support for him, Senate Democrats, I should say. But I find it interesting that they're focusing on him when John Tester and Joe Manchin have much more to lose by backing David Chipman than Angus King does. I mean, Maine is a strong, you know, gun rights state, but it's a purplish state, and Angus King is probably very well positioned to run for another term there if he so chooses. John Tester and Joe Manchin have bigger problems with David Chipman. Those are not just big gun rights states, but they're very red states, and they're barely getting by as it is. Tester and Manchin in their past elections are just skating by, and if they are going to vote for a gun control activist lobbyist for ATF, they're going to have a huge problem. So I was curious as to why, and maybe you have some insight on this, I was curious as to why Politico is focusing on Angus King, of all people, on this.
I think it's because that's where gun control activists are focusing their attention. In this political story that dropped last night, there are a couple of unnamed gun control activists who said that they expect that Manchin and Tesser are ultimately going to vote for David Chipman. Now, I don't know if that's just a little wishful thinking on their part, because as you say, you know, not only are these very pro-Second Amendment states, not only would this be a very big deal. I mean, Montana has a burgeoning firearms industry. There are a number of manufacturers in the state of Montana and a growing number of employees. West Virginia just passed a law designed to attract the firearms industry to set up shop in the state. So, you know, I'm a little puzzled by that as well. But at the same time, Joe Manchin has apparently, you know, worked behind the scenes. He set up a meeting with Jim Justice, the governor of West Virginia, and David Chipman. He apparently organized some sort of Zoom town hall with David Chipman and West Virginia constituents, although I've not been able to find out a whole lot of information about that. So maybe maybe Manchin is trying to do what he can so he can, you know, tell the White House, look, I was a good soldier. I just couldn't get it done in the end. But the bottom line is, to me, if Manchin and Tester really were assured of voting for Chipman, they would have come out and said it. They would have put more pressure on Angus King.
Right.
You know, but all three of them right now are still saying that they're undecided. So I think that Chipman's nomination is maybe in a little bit more trouble than even the gun control advocates want to acknowledge.
I believe that that's the case. And frankly, I'm not sure what you get with David Chipman that makes him worth the bother. David Chipman is somebody who is... I wouldn't say somebody who is really dialed into Washington, D.C., at least not on a bipartisan basis, right? I mean, this isn't somebody who is a former member of Congress, somebody who's, you know, spent a lot of time on Capitol Hill, except as a lobbyist. And as a lobbyist, again, that is a huge political problem for Democrats to push him. Now, I'm curious as to what their plan B is going to be, because I don't see any way they get Chipman across the finish line at this point, unless they're not making a new positive case for him. All they're saying is that, well, it's all those insane Republican, you know, gun nuts that are keeping Chipman from getting his nomination confirmed, when in fact it's three Democrats that are keeping his confirmation at bay. they're going to have to come up with a plan B at some point. And you and I have discussed this on the VIP Gold Chat. I actually have somebody in mind. You're not terribly happy with my suggestion, but you got to admit it makes some political sense.
It does. Val Demings, does make some sense and probably has enough, friends in the Senate that she could get this done. I think Manchin would probably go along with that. But honestly, I don't think they have a plan B at the moment. You know, plan B is probably keep Marvin Richardson in place. He's the acting director of the ATF, and he's been that acting director for several years now. They could try to, elevate him as permanent director, but I don't think gun control activists want that. The bottom line is that gun control activists believe that this is the golden moment for them. They've got one of their staunchest allies in the White House. Theoretically, they have the numbers on paper to put one of their own in charge of this agency, and they know that they'll never have this chance again if they fail. Particularly, they're never going to be able to nominate another gun control activist here, so they're going all in. I'm with you. I mean, I think today, if I had to say what I thought was going to happen, I think Chipman's nomination is going to fail. But I don't want to jinx anything, and I'm a little superstitious, so I'm knocking on wood right now. But I think ultimately they may just leave this open. They may just quietly withdraw, or maybe not even officially withdraw Chipman's nomination and just leave it open. But you look at the number of other appointments that are out there, they're still not filled. I think Joe Biden has something like 200 ambassadorial appointments that are open right now. The administration is having a lot of problems putting some of their key people in place. And so, they can't spend all of their time on Chipman. At some point, you got to cut bait and say, yes. All right, we're done. We got to move on here. And I suspect that point is coming up very quickly.
Well, I think in the key problem here, and this is a problem of Congress's own making, is that they have imbued the ATF director's position with far too much legislative power. And this is a problem across the federal bureaucracy. But I think in the case of the ATF, it's even worse than in other places. There's just far too much ability for an ATF director to issue regulations on his or her own. Those are authorities that really should be reserved for Congress, and the director of the ATF should simply be in charge of the enforcement of whatever laws and regulations that Congress passes. And again, this is not a problem that is particular to the ATF, but because of the nexus of gun control and gun rights conflict here, it's going to make this position nearly unfillable until Congress decides that they're going to restrict ATF's authority of their range. That to me is what the real problem here is, and I don't see Congress doing anything about it anytime soon.
No, I don't either. But you're right. I mean, we've actually got a couple of proposed rules from the ATF right now, one of which would basically redefine firearms to include things that aren't firearms, things that could be turned into a firearm at some point down the line. There's another proposal that would turn about 4 million legally owned firearms into prohibited items under the National Firearms Act, through the regulatory power. I mean, this is a backdoor gun ban. And when an agency has the regulatory authority to impose a gun ban by simply, changing the meaning of words and things like the Gun Control Act of 1968, you're right, Ed. I think Congress does need to step in.
Cam Edwards, we're going to have to leave it at that. Cam Edwards from BearingArms.com. Cam and Company, thanks for being with us. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Hugh. We'll be right back.
Thank you, Ed Morrissey. I'm not there today, of course. Don't forget, ReliefFactor.com. I took it in the first part of the day as soon as I got up on vacation. I take it with me on vacation. The Fetching Mrs. Hewitt has it packed away. Don't leave home without it, and certainly don't go to work this morning. Maybe you have a Texas commute like Ed does, stretching vast in front of you. Endless plains stretching, rolling out with oil wells and tumbleweeds. ReliefFactor.com. Maybe you're in wintry Minnesota and you're listening. It's winter there already. That's why Ed left. Get your ReliefFactor.com. If you're on the beaches of California or sweltering in D.C., take your ReliefFactor.com. Don't forget it. Don't leave home without it. I take it in the first hour, remind you about it hour two and three. Whether you're working out more, getting into shape, or whether you are just getting a little bit older and a little bit more pain because your joints hurt, ReliefFactor.com. Please don't forget it. Go there, 1995, get you started, relieffactor.com. Come right back for more of Ed Morrissey on The Hugh Hewitt Show.
Portions of The Hugh Hewitt Show brought to you by Sierra Pacific Mortgage. For more info, call 888-888-1172.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Hugh today, bringing you the latest of the news from the Pittsburgh Steelers. But before we get to that, we are now going to talk a little about the economy, about the jobs report that's coming out, and especially about inflation. Where can we expect it to go? How does it tie into jobs? Joining us to talk about this is my friend and former radio colleague, King Banyan. He is on Saturday mornings at The Biz AM 1440 in the Twin Cities, and we're both alums of the Northern Alliance Radio Network, which, of course, was sort of championed by Hugh Hewitt, not just sort of championed, very much championed by Hugh Hewitt. King, welcome to the show.
Hey, Ed, thank you. Glad we could be with you today.
We're going to have some big news today. You know, every month we get the jobs report. We got to look at the ADP report a couple of days ago, and while I always feel the need to put a big, huge, ugly asterisk next to ADP report analyses saying, this is not a predictive metric. take this with a large grain of salt sort of thing. I mean, it's actually been a little bit more correlated with BLS data of late, and it came up with a big miss, about half to expectations. In the month of July, they reported 330,000 jobs created, which under normal circumstances would be a pretty good number. But economists were expecting somewhere closer to 660,000. And now that has raised some serious questions as to what we're going to see in about an hour and a half to 2 hours here in about an hour, actually, about an hour away from the BLS report for the month of July. What are you looking at here? What should we be looking for in this jobs report?
Well, you're hearing a number of people say that the number should be somewhere between 800,000. I saw Goldman Sachs was out with like 1.1 million jobs. I'm actually a little bit on the low side of that because I do think that ADP report has been a concern, and just the fact that we seem to be missing more. We've had more optimism on this number than it's turned out. We've missed the expectation on the low side twice, and I kind of think we've just overestimated the ability of the economy to recover. There's sort of a speed limit there, and there's some supply bumps, and I think we're going to see a number that's a little bit below what folks are saying. So I wouldn't be surprised to see something in the 600,000 to 700,000 range. I could be wrong, but and if we are wrong to the high side, it'll be great. The thing to watch, Ed, is what happens with revisions. Will they revise the numbers for May and June up? We always kind of get those sort of under the surface, but those are real jobs that need to be added to the total.
Now, again, just to put this in context, if we see something like 600,000, and if that's the case, you're going to start seeing a lot of people saying, well, it missed expectations. 600,000 would normally be a really great number for a monthly jobs report, except for the fact that we've got millions of jobs that are technically open and nobody taking them. And though the windows on those jobs might be starting to close because of some of the inflationary pressures and some of the supply chain pressures that we're also seeing building up here in the economy. And so it's important to understand that, you know, first off, we're still, I forget how many millions of jobs we are below the pre-pandemic level of employment, but we've still got a long ways to go to recover those jobs. And those jobs are out there. They can't find people in the workforce willing to take them.
Right. We're still about 6.5 million jobs below where we were before the pandemic started. We still have a number of there's that number there. I do think that some folks have stayed out because of unemployment insurance, but I think one thing to point out is a number of people who are about our age, 55 to 65 category, a lot of our folks just said, you know what, I'm done. Back in 2008, we probably didn't have that option because our stock portfolios and our retirement accounts look really bad. They don't. Right. They look great now, right? So So some people may have just said, you know what, I think that's enough. I think I just don't want to take that risk. So thinking we're going to go all the way back to those jobs we had pre-pandemic, I think some of those jobs are just gone because those workers have decided that, they're not going to come back into the workforce.
You know, it's an interesting point, King, and I'm reminded of the fact that that actually was also a phenomenon in 2009, even though the stock portfolios had taken a big hit, is that some of the people in our age cohort, which is, you know, the sprightly gentleman age cohort, I would call it, had decided, yeah, you know, I'm not going to jump back in. On the other hand, a lot of us were delaying. There was also a phenomenon. A lot of us were delaying. A lot of the people in that cohort at the time were delaying retirement for the reason that you just said. So, yeah, I mean, that's certainly a possibility. I'd love to see some data on that. What about inflation? I mean, inflation was supposedly was transitory. I remember them talking about inflation being transitory 3 or 4 months ago. It doesn't look as transitory anymore. What's the impact of that going to be on job growth? What's the impact of that going to be on just growth, regular growth?
Well, as long as it's the case that business owners think they can pass on wage increases to prices, and as long as people have enough money from, you know, $4.5 trillion in stimulus and counting, you can expect that the party will continue and that probably won't be, that inflation will not be restraining on job growth. The bite comes when it turns out that those price increases can't be passed on because all of a sudden a flood of imported goods comes in. That's been held back by the pandemic. Europe is not able to ship us as many goods as they had before. We've got choke points on the West Coast that don't allow as many goods to come in from Asia as they would usually. There are boats backed up. There's container ships backed up at the ports in Long Beach and Los Angeles. So those price increases can go through for now, and that actually helps the jobs report. But on the other hand, it's inflation, and for those living on fixed incomes, it's a real problem. So, I don't want to minimize inflation, but in terms of the jobs report itself, not an issue yet. Will be, I believe, in, I don't know, 6 months, 12 months, I think it would be a huge problem at that point.
Well, it's interesting, too, because I took a look at the last two GDP reports, right? And you take a look at consumer activity, which they call PCEs, personal consumption expendables, or expenditures. And the PCEs were off the charts. I think it was 11.3 and 11.5% growth in each of the two quarters. That's, you know, quarter on quarter percent increases. But both of those are correlated very strongly with large dumps of cash into checking accounts that were passed by Congress. And in the prior quarter to that, it dropped off significantly. And even though you saw consumer activity going up 11.5% in 11.3, 11.5% in the last two quarters, you know, the GDP growth based on that was not as impressive as it should be, right? We were in the mid sixes in both cases. Without a stimulus in the third quarter, and it looks like we're not going to get a stimulus. I mean, nobody's even suggesting that they're going to send more checks out. This is, I think, going to be also a problem for job growth, is that you're going to see consumers start pulling back in part because of the inflation. And that is going to start taking some of those jobs off the table that have been sitting around for a bit. And I think that should be a pretty large concern, because that sugar high is about to evaporate.
Yeah, I think there's a good point in that. I do think you'll burn out a lot of the inflation. Look, people have been stuck at home. They haven't been able to consume services, but they've been buying goods, and they've been buying goods like nobody's business. That probably is in the process of shifting right now to going back to buying more services, going traveling and going to a hotel and all that, willingness to go back to a gym. I'm assuming that the Delta variant at some point phases out like it has in other parts of the world where it hit earlier. So when that happens, that consumption will still be there. Ed, the one thing to pay attention to is the fact that all those goods that got bought, a lot of them were being sold out of inventories, and those inventories have been run down greatly.
Yes.
Over the first half of the year. So I think there'll be some build back of that. So I don't know that the job support will be all that bad for the next few months, because I think for a little bit we're just going to be in restocking mode where you know, you didn't have parts before and they're going to come back and bring those parts. And Ed, pay attention particularly to the semiconductor chip market and the impact it's having on big ticket items like automobiles, which have a significant impact on the GDP numbers. Those sales and those productions won't happen, I still think, for 6 to 12 months, and so you might see some knock-on effect there, even into the first half of 2022.
And we're speaking with King Banyan of AM 1440 The Biz in the Twin Cities, a great Salem affiliate there. And King, I mean, I think people are seeing this in right now. I mean, just my own personal experience. This anecdotal, obviously, not data, but I bought a couple of big ticket items in the last few weeks because I moved to Texas and, you know, I'm getting furniture. This stuff is taking months to show up. A refrigerator that we bought is going to end up taking 2 months to be delivered because things are that backed up. And that is, I think, an inventory issue. And we saw that in the last GDP report where the inventory drain has now become significant. And if businesses can't manufacture to meet future demand to refill that inventory, then that's going to be a problem in Q3. It's a temporary problem, but it's still going to be a problem in Q3.
Yeah, it is, and I think that problem persists, and I think that's the undershoot, and I think that's going back to where we started. That might be a part of the job support, because if I can't get the parts in place to produce the goods, I'm not going to hire workers to sit around and twiddle their thumbs while I'm waiting for the truck to bring my inputs. I'm gonna leave them on the sidelines for a little bit longer. So it is having that impact all the way back through the system.
King Banyan is at 1440 The Biz in the Twin Cities. You can go to TwinCitiesBusinessRadio.com and find his podcast. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Hugh Hewitt. We'll be right back. By Tarzana Joe to give us his thoughts on the developments of the day.
Well, thank you. Actually, it's the developments of a generation, but I'm trying to give it a far-reaching perspective. But we'll go with the developments of the day, Captain.
Sounds good.
This is consent of the governed. The government that governs now has taken the position that they would rather ask us for forgiveness than permission. Now, that's a winning trait if you're a character in fiction. But when you deal in justice, it's a bit of contradiction. To say you lack the power as you also give the order is like opening a highway and calling it a border. Why should we have to bother to fix the court with packing if you can take an action where authority is lacking? Old Joe wouldn't ever think of that. He's such a stand-up guy. He must have been encouraged by the good old FBI. It seems that for the last few years, the least of their offenses was lying to the FISA court and dodging consequences, or giving sketchy answers to investigating groups, and when at last they're called on it, respond by saying, oops. It's really very clever, a sophisticated trick, and if you fail to grasp that, well, you might just be a hick. But if to lawless power you've shown you're an aspirant, I'm taking the position that you might just be a tyrant. That's Consent of the Governed by Tarzana Joe.
A brilliant and concise deconstruction of the trends these days. And you can find more of this, of course, at TarzanaJoe.com. Tarzana Joe, that's terrific.
Nine stanzas, and it's kind of a summary of the decline and fall. You know, so I think it goes as a summary of the day's events, but we'll give it a little bit more perspective.
Let's hope that I was right in the first place, and it's just the day's events, and it's not the generation's events.
Perhaps it's like I'm the curling stone that knocks this trend out of this inner circle. That's a totally terrible metaphor, but what the heck, I try.
I love it, and that's what we're going to go with. Tarzana Joe, TarzanaJoe.com for all sorts of great thoughts on the developments of the day, the week, the year of the generation. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Captain.
I want to remind you that our sponsor is AndrewandTodd.com. There with Sierra Pacific, they lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home, or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to andrewandtodd.com or call them at 888-888-1172.